Let's talk. John Brown. Mining men, Britain's last kings of the coalface, is the story of the last generation of British miners, fathers and sons, brothers and comrades, big hitters and broken men, strikers and scabs. It is the new book by Emily P. Weber, and I'm delighted to say that Emily joins me live on the line now. Emily, good morning to you.
Good morning. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, the pleasure is indeed all mine. Just tell us a little bit about yourself and why you're eminently qualified to write Mining Men.
So the book's actually based on my PhD. So I've spent probably around 6 years researching the British mining industry. And I've interviewed over 100 miners who work in the British mining industry. I've just been listening to their testimonies and also been busy burrowing away in the archives for quite a long time as well.
So what was the thing that sort of sparks the interest in writing Mining Men? Because this is, if you like, are we dealing from sort of mid-70s to the miners' strike, which obviously, if you're my generation, you remember it as if it was yesterday.
Yeah, so it's really looking at the industry from the post-war period onwards. It was actually my mum who inspired the journey. So I was born in South Yorkshire less than a year after the end of the miners' strike. And my mum told me to write about where I came from. And that's exactly what I did. But what I started to realise is that you couldn't really understand the emotions and exactly what was at stake in the miners' strike without really appreciating what the industry meant to its workers and its communities. So that's kind of what I set about investigating.
Because, I mean, mining is different, coal mining is different, and the whole sort of genesis of the UK as an industrial power is based on mining. It is dangerous, it is dirty, and it's not only impacts the men, but the communities themselves, the women themselves. It's not like an agriculture community, is it?
No, I mean, the risks were pretty unparalleled. And even in the 1970s, it was one of the riskiest occupations in the UK. And so I found it really fascinating that men remembered the industry with such fondness. And that, again, is something perhaps that would be unexpected for an outsider perspective. But they really, really felt very strongly attached to the industry as a result of kind of the relationships that were formed underground. And I think also that in part, again, was because of the risks that men really had to look after each other. And so in a past life, I used to manage research at the Imperial War Museum. And I was fascinated by ideas of camaraderie, particularly in the First World War and the PALS battalions. And I was always interested if there was an equivalent outside of the theatre of conflict. And in mining, I really did find that, you know, that men would risk their lives to help each other out underground when something went wrong. So yeah, it was some of the accounts have been incredibly moving.
But if you think about it, it's the same kind of background, because you're in a situation that can be incredibly dangerous. You look after each other, and unless you've been down a mine, and you know, I'm from Stoke-on-Trent, and I've been down a mine, and the claustrophobic atmosphere, you know, at one point they turned the lights off, you know, and it was just like horrendous. And so for an outsider looking in, it's very difficult to explain what it's like to face that every day.
It really is. But I think the men's accounts, because there were so many of them, and, you know, they really, really did take me back there in their stories. And I hope I've managed to do justice to that in the book. But I think it, because of the very, very unique environment, again, that was another thing that's really stayed with them. And when the pit closures happened and they could no longer work underground, there was no equivalent. They could never go back there. And yet it really has stuck in their memory. And so many men told me about dreaming at night. They would dream and they would be back in the pit and the smells would be back in the darkness. So it's a really, really fascinating industry. And again, one that has no parallel.
And also there's that whole thing about, because of where the mines are, obviously the Rhondda, Yorkshire, where you're from yourself, and Scotland as well, there is that sort of distrust of, if you like, sort of soft Whitehall and politicians, because, you know, miners have always been United. I mean, remember that the miners united will never be defeated, etc. And perhaps, you know, people, the governments, successive governments really haven't bought mining communities, have they?
No. And I think they've been done a massive injustice historically. If we look at the communities today, they are still suffering. And this is now 40 years on as a result of the way in which the pit closure program was enacted. So I think there is very justifiably so, still a mistrust. I know that there are a lot of wonderful community initiatives happening and a lot of people trying to kind of really celebrate the heritage of what was a wonderful, you know, industry at times in terms of bringing people together and community spirit. But yes, I am familiar with the mistrust, and it's something that's definitely been shared with me during interviews.
Because the thing as well, I mean, it was kind of painted as we said, mining is dirty and dangerous, but you've touched on something there, which is community. And, yes. You know, everybody works together. Those in the mines go to the same pubs. There are social events. The whole town or whatever is based around that. And rather than today where people are in various different service industries or whatever they're doing, working from home or whatever, you know, everybody kind of knows everybody else. So there's that shared camaraderie, which you mentioned before, not only is those going down the mines, but as I said before, with the women and the support industries to the mines themselves.
Yeah. And that's really what kind of was the thing that sustained the strike for as long as it did. I mean, it was incredible. I mean, these communities, they were not rich communities, but because they looked after each other, supported each other, the women were incredible during the strike in terms of running kitchens and food distribution. That was the time at which it was really evident that these communities were something really very special, that they were able to look after each other, support each other, get each other through things. That was what makes it incredibly sad, that the loss of really this sense of identity for those communities with the loss of the industry. And when the pits closed, it killed communities. And it really, again, there's such a sense of pathos now that's been lost. But part of what I wanted to do with the book was celebrate what that was. You know, I think because of the strike and because of kind of how divisive it was in some communities, that the actual goodness of the industry and, you know, the way in which these communities looked after each other and all of that had kind of been lost a little bit. So with the book, I wanted to really celebrate mining culture, what it meant, you know, and what true camaraderie meant. And yes, both underground, but also in sense of these wonderful communities.
Because I think we're now sort of 40 years on from the miners' strike. Yeah. We need to sort of reappraise, I think, you know, what they were standing for and what the communities meant. Because at the time, you know, obviously, you know, Margaret Thatcher was the Prime Minister. She basically painted the miners as almost a fifth column, didn't she, at the time? And they were going to sort of overthrow almost the UK government, and it was an old industry and it was dying. And there were Arthur Scargo was basically, in some corners, he was the devil incarnate, if you were reading half the press at the time. And there was, what was it, the People's Republic of South Yorkshire, wasn't it? That was the thing.
Yes, indeed. But I feel as though we really, really do a massive disservice in remembering mining communities in that way. At the end of the day, people were defending their jobs and they were defending the right for the survival of their communities. And also, lest we forget that for many of these men, you know, their fathers, their grandfathers, you know, even further back, you know, were in the industry. Sometimes they'd actually dug the pits that these men were working to. So there was enormous family attachment to these pits. And it was the whole community suffered as a result. And, you know, not people unrelated to the industry, you know, the corner shop, the local pub, it really did destroy those communities. But I think because of the fact that miners were misrepresented, I would say, as being these hyper-militant, hyper-masculine characters during the strike. And that was really amplified in a lot of the press, that, you know, we lost track of really what they were fighting for. And they were just ordinary men and women and families who just wanted to make sure that, you know, there was a job for their sons to go into. So, that's also what I was trying to remedy, really, this what I felt was the misrepresentation of who the British miner was.
Yeah, because there was a whole, wasn't there, the whole sort of flying picket situation and police charges and almost pitched battles. And a member of my family was a policeman in South Yorkshire. And whilst all that madness is going on, you know, with the horses, everybody remembers, he said he spent his entire time playing cricket with the miners because they were on a very quiet pit. So that whole, and he said it was great for his bowling arm, but he said, you know, that whole misrepresent us v them and what the miners stood for wasn't a true picture.
No, I mean, I think certainly in terms of local police forces, I heard some lovely stories of how, you know, they would give picket sandwiches on the picket lines and things like that. I think the issue came when you had police from outside forces, particularly from the Met, coming in, and they just didn't respect the communities. And they, you know, they took a very, very hard line. And that was when the division really, really sparked off. But, you know, one of the interviewees in, I think it's the first chapter, he was a miner and then became a police officer. And he was involved in policing the strike. And for him, that was really, really difficult being stood on the other side of the picket line. But he basically told everybody, you need to respect these men. You know, these are proud men. They're defending their jobs, you know, and that was very much the message that he communicated to his police force who were there.
Yeah, it's really interesting the sort of relationship that, as I said before, governments have with the mining industry, because obviously during the Second World War, the Bevan Boys, etc., you know that they were exempt from, if you like, joining the armed forces. Yeah. I mean, coal is the thing that powers, you know, the empire at the time. So to dismiss them suddenly as you know, when there's a war on, their heroes, but when they want better wages to stop the pits closing, they're the militant tendency.
Exactly. And I think, again, I mean, you look at the First World War, they were the tunnelers under the battlefields of the First World War. You know, they've always been there for us. And so, again, to this idea of the enemy within that Margaret Thatcher brought in, it was just the most horrific turn. Like, you know, we've relied on these people. These people are working in jobs that few people would tolerate. And yet they were able to do that to them. So, again, and I feel as though, as a result, a lot of the historical narrative after the strike has focused on the strike. And so with the book, I just really wanted to do the industry justice. I wanted to talk about the Bevan Boys, and I wanted to talk about men, you know, who dedicated their lives to the industry. You know, a lot of them came away with some really catastrophic injuries as a result, but they felt truly proud of the role that they'd played in making Britain. And so, yeah, I wanted to make sure that that was put on paper for people of my generation and, you know, future generations, that they could remember it in the right way.
And also, I mean, we say the miners, but obviously different perspectives. There's no blanket, you know, broad stroke. I mean, a miner in the Rhondda has a different experience to a miner in South Yorkshire. So how fascinating was that to sort of speak to? There's mines in Kent as well, aren't there?
Yes, there are mines in Kent. And again, I dedicate two chapters to miners from Kent, because not many people realise that there were coal mines in Kent. And again, I really wanted to make sure that they were given recognition. But yeah, I mean, I travelled all over the coal fields. And actually, there was a huge amount of different experiences and different characters. What's interesting, from the 70s onwards, you get a real kind of change in terms of miners' roles underground. So you get, you know, qualified electricians, engineers. These are highly skilled men. So there was a huge spectrum of experience that I encountered. But that was what was really lovely about doing it, was that I wanted to kind of smash through stereotypes with it and really showcase all manner of different characters and explore the meaning that they brought to their work. But the single thing that stayed with me, though, was this idea of camaraderie. That was in every single person I spoke to, was, you know, that was the fundamental thing that they remembered and, you know, missed from their time underground, was the way in which people would look after each other. So yeah, it was very powerful that came through.
And it's quite ironic, isn't it, that people are probably going to get the experience of what mining communities are probably through sort of Billy Elliot. So, you know, all the miners went off and danced or brassed off or something like that.
Yeah, and sometimes I find that whilst it's great, I love Rostov, some of those narratives can frame miners in a certain way as being, you know, quite resistant to change, or, you know, quite hyper-masculine. And again, I wanted to actually show the real men who were, you know, very different from those portrayals often. So yes, I think, again, that was another thing I wanted to address.
Yeah, and also because a lot of the men sort of qualify themselves. I mean, this is obviously 40 years ago, so it's kind of different. They qualify themselves through their work. And when the work is gone, the men can't kind of handle it, and the women take over that matriarchal society as well.
Yeah, I mean, the women, and I think, again, that is perhaps something that's been overplayed a little bit, because I would argue that women in mining communities have always been incredibly powerful, strong figures, you know, the real backbone of the family. I think, yes, in the aftermath of pit closures, there was perhaps more of an even distribution of labour as men went on to have to find different jobs. But I think the women have always been formidable in mining communities. You know, they've been, at the end of the day, the ones who have had to get their families through thick and thin when men have been out of work or when men have been injured or sick. And they are the kind of hands that tie the community together. So I've made sure, hopefully, that women are well represented in the book as well. But I think the one thing you talked, obviously, about work identities, what again was really interesting is, as you say, you know, 40 years on, the vast majority of the men I spoke to still identified themselves as miners. So even if they'd been in all manner of different occupations, they still identified as miners through their culture and through their principles. And that was something that came through very strongly in the interviews that I did.
If the industry sort of, an industry that big closed down today, there'd be support, there'd be sort of retraining the whole situation. And a friend of mine who was a miner, we called him Jockey. He was from Scotland, strangely enough. And he said they got some payoffs. And basically, if you're a single bloke, you blew it within a month. You got a big TV and went down the pub, and then sort of like 6 months later, they were absolutely stranded. There was that, you know, communities did kind of break up, or there was mass unemployment, wasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, other countries did it better in terms of, you know, as they took away those sorts of heavy industries, they replaced them with other initiatives. We didn't do that. And again, I think that was a lot down to the attitude of the government at the time, that they perhaps wanted to teach the miners a lesson. And there were kind of little bits of training here and there. There was no equivalent, you know, there was no equivalent jobs put in place for people. And the men I spoke to ended up in all manner of careers. You know, some went on to work in factories. One chap became a driving instructor. Another chap became a school caretaker. But there was no equivalent to what they had. And in terms of the pride that they took in their work, it was very, very difficult to find something that could give them that again.
What do you think that sort of the UK lost as a result of the miners' strike and then the closure of the pits?
Well, I think the community's lost hugely. And, you know, we still feel that today. I think they lost a sense of identity. They obviously lost employment, and they lost employment for future generations. But, you know, these were proud communities. And I think they really felt, A, that, you know, the government had done them a massive injustice. And B, you know, who are we now? Like, what is there for our children to go on to do? What opportunities are there? And so I think that was hugely lost. I think the interesting thing is about the mining culture, and I talk about this in the book, that's still there. You know, it's still, in terms of communities looking after each other, that still very much exists. And, you know, a pride in ideas of camaraderie still exist. And we see them, you know, at the Durham Miners Gala and things like that. So, I that didn't die out. But certainly, you know, communities were left devastated. And you feel it in pit communities that I've been around. You can still feel the fact that, you know, there hasn't been opportunity. And I know that numerous attempts have been made to try and correct that. But, you know, I don't think in real terms it's made a huge difference as yet. And I don't think the real investment's been made properly.
You were a researcher, weren't you, at the European Imperial War Museum?
Yes.
And so with that, you're working with sort of diaries, letters, communications from perhaps 175, 80 years before then. But in this case, you had primary sources, which is obviously great, wonderful to have. So how willing were people to talk about this? And how did you find the right people to interview?
So I put out a couple of calls in newspapers in coalfield communities, and I also put a call out on social media. There's a lot of mining groups on social media, and I got a fair amount of interest early on. So started touring around the coalfields and speaking to different people, and then of course the pandemic happened, which I hadn't really anticipated, and I was at home homeschooling my two children. And kind of going, I don't know how I'm going to interview people now. And so I just decided I'll do it by correspondence. So I put again something out going, does anybody want to share mining memories with me? You know, I'll write back to you. It would be lovely. And I received a tidal wave of mining memories, you know, huge unpublished memoirs that had been not shared with anybody other than immediate family. And just, it was really overwhelming. One elderly gentleman had dictated a lovely letter via one of his neighbours that he posted on to me, which was just beautiful, all about working as a Bevan boy. And so I was like, my goodness, this is incredible. And so then a few people came through and said, actually, I'd still like to talk to you. Can we do it on Zoom? And again, that's never really been done before in oral history terms. And I was a bit like, oh, I don't know, what about doing online interviews? How's that going to work? But they became the most wonderful interviews. You know, they'd go on for a lot longer actually than in-person interviews. You know, they'd stretch late into the evening, and it became such a highlight of my day. You know, I'd done with all the homeschooling, my children were safely in bed, and then at 8 o'clock at night I'd open up my laptop and just disappear into somebody else's life for a few hours and learn all about, you know, the pit and really the meaning that they had in their work and, you know, what they missed. And it was the greatest privilege to be trusted with these testimonies. And some of them were incredibly moving. Some of them were very funny as well. So, yeah, it was just brilliant.
Yeah, because, I mean, as I said before, we don't, if you're not from a mining community, you probably don't get it. And that's perhaps the most, you know, the most wonderful thing about this. But what are you hoping that people are going to learn from Mining Men?
I want them to realise the contribution that miners and their communities made to this country. I want them to really appreciate that, because I think it's really overlooked in history because of how the industry ended. And I want to shine a light on actually the brilliance of these communities, how they came about, and actually what they stood for and what mining really meant to people in terms of the culture, the principles about looking after each other. And I think that there's something that we can all learn from it today. I certainly came away from doing the research feeling like a better person for having learned from these men's lives and kind of what camaraderie really meant. So, yeah, I really hope people take that away.
The book is called Mining Men, Britain's Last Kings of the Coal Face. It's by Emily P. Weber. If people want to find you online, Emily, is there a website? Is there social media? Where can they look you up?
Yeah, so there's emilypweber.com, and I'm also on the Penguin website as well, Emily P. Weber, and the book's there.
And you'll also be able to order it from our own virtual bookstore. The book is called Mining Men. It's by Emily P. Weber. Emily, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you ever so much. It's been wonderful.